This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The world trembles at the edge of the largest pandemic since the Spanish flu of 1918, when millions of people died. The stock market is shuddering under the strain of a shutdown of the world's workshop in China, and possibly in Japan and South Korea.
I mean, what are you going to do if you're advised to be in isolation because of a disease outbreak, but at the same time, flooding hits your local community and you're advised to evacuate? I mean, we can't follow both of those at the same time.
Various countries, including the UK and the northern US, have been hit with extreme precipitation events at the same time. If China's industrial pollution continues at a lower rate and airline traffic tanks, we may expect some extreme warming and possible heat waves in the Northern Hemisphere earlier than this summer. Will the consumer bomb that threatened the climate and the species of the world stumble? What could replace it? Sean Chamberlain brings us more of his dark optimism and a way forward in the new film, The Sequel. That is coming up next. Later, I will bring you science with very good news and some sort of hope. A study just released suggests you do not have to worry about a rapid rise of methane thawing out of the Arctic, at least not in this century.
The rate of methane increase today is about as high or higher than what we've ever seen in all ice core history.
Michael Dionysius and his team say frozen methane on the seabed will not reach the atmosphere, and thawing permafrost is not behind the recent rise in this dangerous greenhouse gas, methane. We have found the real enemy, and of course it is us. Methane from the fossil fuel industry, along with more from tropical bogs as we heat those up. That's the real worry. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. On Radio EcoShock, March 2019, Sean Chamberlain told us about the amazing lean logic provided by the late UK alternative economist David Fleming. It points to a way out, a path to a future you would actually like to live in. Now Sean is back with a big release this March. The keystone is a new film called The Sequel, What Will Follow Our Troubled Civilization? It was created by an award-winning British director and based on the work of David Fleming. Sean advises groups from Chelsea Green Publishing to the UK Department of Energy and Climate Change. He co-authored a report to Parliament and co-founded Transition Town Kingston. Sean heads the Fleming Policy Centre and continues his seminal blog, Dark Optimism.
Radio EcoShock.
Your new film, and really the whole essence of David Fleming's logic, it seems to me, is that we can create a happier, more human sequel to our sorry state of affairs. But to have a sequel, something has to end. Sean, do you think something is ending now?
Yes. I think a lot of things are ending now. I think, I often go back to this line by William Gibson, the science fiction writer, who said, "The future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed." And I think there's a shrinking circle of affluence in which people can still sit around and say, you know, where's your apocalypse then, mate? We're in a situation where unthinkable numbers of wild creatures, non-humans, are dying. You know, we've lost more than half the wild vertebrates on Earth over the last 50 years. And the majority of people on Earth are living in increasingly dire circumstances. So it's pretty clear to me that this is the sort of dominant global system is one that, I don't know if on the last legs is enough of a statement, but is falling over as we speak. And as you say, one of the beauties of David's work is not that he's saying, hey, we can make all this good and collapse isn't going to happen and it's all going to be fine. But it's saying as much, if not more, about what we've lost already and stand to regain as about what we've stand to lose, and the fact that, you know, instead of desperately trying to preserve a system that seems to be preserving the wealthy people in actually unhappy circumstances with huge rates of depression and mental illness and suicide and everything else, and destroying the ability of life on Earth to continue in order to support that, we can definitely do something a lot better than that. So it's not necessarily that the future is going to be more materially affluent or comfortable than the present, But it could be an awful lot better than the future we're currently headed towards.
Well, for openers, would you explain David's idea of Carnival?
Wow, that's a big question. I would say that the essence of David's economics, because he was a historian and an economist, is that growth, economic growth, is not something that can continue indefinitely. I don't think we need to get into the reasons for that too much in this particular talk. But then he was like, okay, so then we're in this impossible situation. We've got an economic system that's completely based on economic growth. And if we keep growing, then we're going to completely overwhelm the ecological limits of our planet. If we don't keep growing, our system's going to collapse, but that's going to happen either way. So what he asked was, well, what's going to come after that inevitable collapse? He didn't think that we were going to see some, you know, huge ecological consciousness awakening and everyone was going to reduce their consumption and the whole green dream. He sort of worked on that for 10 or 20 years back in the 70s and 80s and didn't see that it was going to happen. So his question was, given where we're headed, what will come after? And he looked historically at, well, how did humanity thrive on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years before economic growth and market-based growth? And essentially, his answer was, before economic growth, what sustained human well-being, and indeed non-human well-being, was culture. That as people participated in communal activities, including very much so carnival, that created the relationships and the grounding for mutual support and continuing thriving. I mean, his books, Surviving the Future and Moon Logic, explain in beautifully written detail how that works as an economic system. But essentially, he's arguing that it was things like carnival that provided the alternative to growth before growth became totally dominant and will inevitably provide what's left afterwards. Because as we all know, when you fall on hard times financially, when you can no longer look for your security in money, what we do as people, as communities, is we inevitably start relying on our relationships again. That's what always has caught people as financial security falls away, and it will do again in the future. So his focus on community and conviviality and carnival is not just, you know, an answer to this sort of thing that we're longing for and lacking very often in modern sort of atomized wealthy countries. It's also very much the only practical economic answer to the times that we're facing.
Well, as we speak, there is a pandemic threatening the world, but that will pass. But during the novel coronavirus outbreak, experts advise business and schools to switch to work-at-home solutions. And I worry that COVID-19 is merely cementing a trend towards self-isolation already. I mean, we're more attached to our screens instead of human contact, and we have our online friends, but few friends in the real world for many people. What do you feel about that, Sean?
I mean, it does strike me that as these crises are taken in isolation, the advice between the two can overlap. I mean, what are you going to do if you're advised to be in isolation because of a disease outbreak, but at the same time, flooding hits your local community and you're advised to evacuate? I mean, we can't, you know, we can't follow both of those at the same time, and very often the planning for one is faced by a completely different set of organizations and actors than the planning for another. But you're right. I mean, it is another factor that can encourage people to not interact with their friends, their neighbours, their community. But as you say, I think that's something which is likely to pass as previous, well, it's not quite a pandemic yet officially, I believe, but as previous pandemics have. And again, you know, if you are forced to self-isolate, one approach is to do all of your interactions via, I don't know, ordering your food online, etc. Another approach, again, is to have a community, to have people around you who can, you know, maybe they leave it at the door or whatever, but who can actually support and provide the kind of human reassurance and interaction that we need, actually a lot more than the purely kind of material things that we can get through the internet economy. So again, you know, for me, the appropriate response to the interlinked crises, the climacteric, as David puts it, is to fall back on the economies that have always supported life and flourishing on Earth, which are firstly the ecology, you know, which we need to defend and rebuild, and secondly, again, the kind of informal economy, the economy of relationships, the economy of the gift.
Well, yes, I think it was in our interview last year where you brought it out that we do know how to live, and we do know how to live without fossil fuels, so we can learn some things from the past.
Absolutely. I mean, my best friend Mark Boyle, recently wrote a book called The Way Home, and he's been living for the past 18 months now without electricity, not just off-grid, but without electricity, without running water. And he wrote a line that really struck me, which was, we're often told that this kind of talk is accused of romanticizing the past, but I think the much greater danger is romanticizing the future, and it's the people that are doing that that we need to be really a lot more wary of. You know, if we recognize that the path we've taken is headed for a dead end, there's nothing wrong with going, the path that we've been taking has consequences that we don't want. So what can we learn from the paths we've taken before that maybe didn't have those consequences? There's a line in David Fleming's work that forward motion is not helpful at all when what is needed is a change of direction. And unfortunately, our idea of progress seems to be very strongly limited to a particular kind of progress rather than actually considering the consequences of where that path is leading.
I remember in his book, Discipline and Punish, the French philosopher and historian Michel Foucault wrote about the plague in late medieval times, and there are some lessons there for the present, but he explained that the plague enabled a more coordinated authoritarian state, our modern form of government, as a necessary response to disease. I'm wondering if that could happen again.
Well, I mean, certainly myself, I'm quite familiar with Foucault from having done a philosophy degree, etc., and certainly the existentialists and all of that. But, I mean, really what I took as the thrust of your question was the kind of authoritarianism which does thrive on threats. I mean, whether it be pandemic or whether it indeed be, you know, climate change and environmental calamity, there's a real thread in politics of, well, here's a huge problem, so give me all the power and I'll keep you safe. And it can be very tempting when people are feeling lost and afraid to grab hold of that. And really that's, you know, in many ways, again, the essence of David's work and my work and the kind of message we're trying to bring about with this film is that we need to trust in ourselves and each other. You know, ultimately, it's always very tempting to look to some higher power, whether that be a god or a dictator or whatever, to take away our responsibility for dealing things which we're perhaps intimidated by or overwhelmed by. But ultimately, there is no higher thing to appeal to in that way. You know, politicians are people too, and there is no magical mandate that gives them the ability and the insight to know exactly what needs to be done. And indeed, history teaches us. There's a line in David's work, something like, if a member of our family had a decision-making record on a par with the record of government, it would be a kindness to take them into a home. And we really need to trust in our ability as, not so much as individuals, but as communities, as groups of friends, trust in our ability and our own judgment. And really, that's the message of all of our work, is let's believe that we actually know what's needed at the local level. We know what our skills are, what our resources are, what our needs are, and we're far better placed to make the decisions about appropriate courses of action than centralized authorities.
Well, David Fleming, to my mind, earned his reputation as a green economist and an alternative economist, but like Lord Acton, he never published his magnum opus before dying suddenly in 2010. You published it posthumously. How did that become a film? What's the title of the film, and how did that become a film?
Well, the title of the film is the sequel, What Will Follow Our Troubled Civilization? And the story really is that after the books, in fact, came out, so David's magnum opus, as you put it, it's called Lean Logic, A Dictionary for the Future and How to Survive It. And I edited out from that a paperback called Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. Those came out about 3 years ago now. And off the back of that, they've become very popular. I've been leading a number of courses at various colleges based around that work and had people basically get in touch saying that they're really keen to spread this message. So as well as there are three things actually being launched on March 16th. One is the film, which was made by Peter Armstrong, the director, who is, I don't know how well this translates in America, but over here we have BAFTA, which is the British Academy of Film and Television something. And Peter has a Lifetime Achievement Award from them and got in touch with me because he'd been reading Lean Logic and was really keen to sort of translate this message into the film medium. Sterling College in the US, in Vermont, have developed an online course based around surviving the future, which we're also launching on March 16th. And when I taught a course in, I think, 2017 at Schumacher College in the UK, one of the students there, Matthew Taylor, was very keen to develop an online version of Lean Logic. Because for those who are familiar with it will know it's kind of, David sort of pre-invented Wikipedia, if you like. It's each entry in the dictionary, where there's a word that has its own entry, there's a star next to it. So it's almost like a hyperlinked dictionary. And Matthew was very keen to make it actually a hyperlinked dictionary. And so also we're going to be launching that on March the 16th. So all these different resources have kind of come out of different groups and individuals who've fallen in love with David's writing and his vision for the kind of future we could create together, and have wanted to kind of bring that to different audiences and different mediums. And these have all come to fruition at around the same time.
Is there a website or a Facebook page where our listeners can get up to date and find out what's happening with the sequel?
Yep, it's thesequel.net, and the launch event in London, the sort of central launch event on March 16th, I'll be speaking with Kate Raworth and Rob Hopkins and Caroline Lucas, MP. And that event is now sold out, but it's going to be live streamed by Extinction Rebellion. So anyone who wants to follow that event, it'll start at around 7 p.m. UK time. And on the main, if you go to thesequel.net, there'll be a link there to the Extinction Rebellion live stream. And there are also sort of viewing events happening in England, Scotland and the US, which will be showing the film in cinemas and then live streaming the speaker's discussion from London after that. It's all at thesequel.net for all the details.
Right. Well, we do broadcast in London over Resonance FM, so we should be able to get some of your London listeners. But people around the world can just watch the streaming version, and I think that's the way to go. I want to ask you, Sean Chamberlain, what is the relationship between you, Extinction Rebellion, and Fleming's Lean Logic?
Well, the relationship between me and Lean Logic is fairly straightforward, as we've covered after David passed away. I found his manuscript for that and brought it to posthumous publication with Chelsea Green Publishing. Extinction Rebellion, I was one of the early arrestees back in 2018 when Extinction Rebellion first kicked off, and have been involved since, been in all the rebellions that have taken place here in England. And so I would say that over the past year or so, my main role has been that as Extinction Rebellion has grown and had many, many, many more people get involved with it, I think like any movement, as more people get involved, it becomes sort of diluted in terms of the depth of engagement that the average participant has had with the underlying insights and motivation. So, you know, I'd be out on the street during 2019 with Extinction Rebellion and talking to people, and increasingly I would find that a lot of them might have a more simplistic view of the challenge we face, like, oh, all we need to do is replace fossil fuels with renewable energy, for example, and then, you know, that'll be the problem solved. Whereas I know that a lot of the sort of founders and core people within Extinction Rebellion see it as a much more interconnected, interrelated, climacteric-style problem than that. And so a lot of the work I've been doing has been giving talks to Extinction Rebellion groups about, yes, the kind of scale of the interlinked problems that we face, but also about the sequel. Like, what is it that we're actually demanding? What is it that we actually want here? And using David Fleming's work in Lean Logic as the most beautiful rendering that I've found of that potential of what we're actually striving and working for. And it's been very striking that, I mean, as you know, my work goes under this name of dark optimism, and I find that quite often it can be sort of frustrating when you want to talk to someone about the optimism part. You want to talk to someone about, you know, what it is that we can do in the context of these difficult times to make things better than they would otherwise be. But if people are very new to the darkness, if people are very new to the fundamental ecological and other catastrophic problems that we face, then your initial conversations inevitably end up being about that. And if you actually want to talk about, well, what do we do about them, it can be hard to get past the initial sort of dark night of the soul. And what's been beautiful for me about Extinction Rebellion is that most of the people who are getting involved are very, very familiar with at least a lot of the problems, and are quite often in a place where they're incredibly ready to hear about some kind of story of what we can collectively do to make things better. And also, I think one other thing that's really come out a lot in my work with Extinction Rebellion is that I've, again, not in the kind of founders and spokespeople of Extinction Rebellion, but I think among a lot of the sort of ordinary participants, as you might say, fellow rebels, this kind of sense of disgust at humanity, which is completely understandable when you look at, you know, what's unfolding on the face of the planet. But what I've been really trying to do is drive home this idea that it's not humanity that's the problem per se, because humanity has existed for hundreds of thousands of years without driving catastrophic climate change or causing comparable extinction rates or teetering on the brink of nuclear annihilation. The problem is this culture. There are still human beings living on the planet now who are living in ways that are perfectly compatible with a future. And it can be very dangerous, I think, this idea that humanity is, you know, just a virus or a plague or a cancer or whatever, because it's a very small step from that kind of thinking to self-loathing, to a sense of, you know, oh, well, I should just kill myself because humanity is this kind of evil thing. And I think it's very, very important that we challenge that idea, because the reality is that it's culture that's the problem. Cultures can change a lot faster than genetics can change. And we need to aim our very appropriate disgust at what's unfolding on the face of the planet at the individuals and the institutions and the policies that are sustaining that culture, rather than turning them into, you know, self-hatred, which doesn't lead anywhere useful at all. And so, yeah, really, I've been speaking a lot about this, the PARS, what it looks like to live a life of complete rejection of what is an omnicidal culture, but absolutely not a rejection of one's own humanity and power.
Given his desire for a more local, real society, what was Fleming's position on the UK and the EU? Would he have approved of Brexit or of the new nationalist isolationism that's trying to flower in the United States?
It's a very interesting question, and I have to always preface any answer to that question with, you know, obviously I can't authoritatively speak for David, since he's not with us anymore, and this isn't something that we personally discussed. That said, I think there are definite clues in his writing. In the entry Nation in the Logic, he writes, there is a reduced chance in a centralized setting such as that being developed by the European Union of rebuilding a stabilized society from the bottom up. And I would suspect, I personally voted to remain in the European Union, but without strong sense that that was the right vote. I suspect David would have voted to leave, but I think that he, you know, it frustrates me a bit. I don't know how the discourse on this is on your side of the pond, but over here, certainly among sort of green lefties, there's sort of been a sense that anyone who voted for Brexit must have been a deluded idiot or a racist, basically. And I think that does leave out a lot of very understandable motivations. I think that, you know, the desire for more accountable control and more localization, recognition of the economic truth that the unlimited movement of both people and capital does tend to drive down wages for the working class. And I think probably above all, a desire to reclaim a clear identity as a nation, which I think is something that people rightly or wrongly have felt is threatened. I think that these are very understandable motivations, and it's been a big problem that ever since the Brexit vote, which caught most people by surprise, there's been this real drive to separation. I think one of the most beautiful responses to the vote was by a church called St. Ethelburgers, which is actually going to be the host for our launch event next month. And they immediately held open listening days where people, no matter which way they voted, could come together and be invited to go up to the centre and just speak about what they were feeling and what they were thinking, and without anyone responding, just listening, so that people could actually understand where different perspectives were coming from. And I think that's, you know, that's what's really been lacking. And what I find most sort of exciting about David Fleming's work is that it's, you know, if Brexit is the path that we're taking, which it now clearly is, then we need to sort of reclaim it from the xenophobes and the racists who do see it as a kind of a vindication. Because while, you know, globalization and neoliberalism are destroying our collective future, but I think the one common factor between votes like Brexit, like Trump, like Bolsonaro, have been this sort of desperate rejection of the establishment and the status quo. I mean, it's really interesting that in this country, all the major parties supported remaining in the European Union. And it was when I realized that was the first time I took seriously the possibility that we might be leaving, because there's such anger at politics at the moment. And again, you were saying before about sort of authoritarianism, it's really important to remember that fascists like Mussolini, like Hitler, they didn't only consolidate power on the basis of lies and fear. They also raised wages, addressed unemployment, improved working conditions. And I think if we are going to avoid what currently looks like a drift towards sort of real fascism, what we need to present is an alternative politico-economic vision that restores identity and pride and economic well-being, like a beautiful story of how we will make the future better for the desperate rather than a fearful one. And for me, that's what's most exciting about David Fleming's work, is that his economics based in trust, in loyalty and local diversity is the most sort of grounded, realistic alternative I've seen to a political future that I have no desire to live through.
I do hear some dark optimism in exactly what you're saying now, but there is a tension between a strong desire for localization and yet a need to deal with global problems, whether it's a pandemic or climate change. Is there a lean logic there to resolve that kind of tension?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the best known line from David's work is large-scale problems do not require large-scale solutions. They require small-scale solutions within a large-scale framework. And that, I mean, it actually literally changed my life when I first encountered that line, I guess, around 15 years ago. Because at that time, I was thinking about, you know, maybe going to work for the United Nations and work on their climate change policy and stuff like this. And when I encountered that line, it struck me as so true. You know, all the emissions are ultimately coming from localities of one kind or another. But if people just act at the local level, then they become like these, you know, individual atomized drops in the ocean, which are completely overwhelmed by the path of globalization. That's why ever since then, all of my work, from being involved with the outset of the Transition Towns movement to the Ecological Land Cooperative, like everything that I do has been based on that line of thought. How do we create large-scale frameworks that can unify a diversity of local actions and make them scalable to address large-scale problems? Because, again, it's not large-scale solutions that we need. It's large-scale frameworks that harness a diversity and encourage and stimulate and support a diversity of local responses. And without getting into the whole content of the book, this is absolutely something that David's work draws on very heavily. And that same entry on nation, which I mentioned earlier, ends with the line, the local needs the nation, and talks about the ways in which those kinds of national frameworks can have a healthy relationship with the local and be grounded in that again, rather than being in opposition to that.
So I'm beginning to see a kind of pathway into your work and into David Fleming's work here, where people might begin with the film, the sequel, because we're very used to visual content, and then go in with your kind of introduction to David's work or summary of it, Surviving the Future. And then we've got this whole dictionary that we can keep referring back to, Lean Logic, a dictionary for the future. Do you think that's a reasonable pathway?
I think that's absolutely spot on. In fact, one reader recently described Lean Logic to me as, they said they think of Lean Logic as almost like an appendix to Surviving the Future. The film is an introduction. Surviving the Future is an incredibly warm and readable and humorous pathway in. And then Lean Logic, yeah, as a kind of reference work to draw on as we do the work, because that's ultimately what it's all about, not sitting and watching films or doing the work. I mean, I heard a line recently, I forget where from, but it was, it's far easier to act our way into new ways of thinking than to think our way into new ways of acting. And I think that's incredibly true. And so I think the important thing is that we start doing something, not just reading and watching, but reading and watching can absolutely be a very helpful way of both inspiring and motivating ourselves and thinking about what we should actually do. But it's very important. And I know for myself, I have a tendency sometimes to get too much into the process of thinking and writing and not so much into the hands-on stuff.
On March 16th, you should be able to stream that presentation by Sean Chamberlain, Carolyn Lucas, and more from the Extinction Rebellion website at rebellion.earth. Also check out darkoptimism.org and Sean's book, Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. That's an even more necessary read now in these precarious times.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Have you worried that a big burp of methane will boil out of the Arctic Sea and roast us all with sudden heat? You know, the Arctic methane bomb hypothesis. Brand new science, published in two top journals, concludes that is not going to happen anytime soon. Even though a couple of Russian scientists have pushed this fear, is it a distraction from that country's massive methane emissions due to their natural gas production and pipelines? The real methane we have to fear is coming from the oil and gas industry, says Michael Dionysius, lead author or co-author in two of those new studies. For anyone concerned about climate change, this interview is stunning, good and bad news. Are you worried about the methane monster bursting out of the permafrost or the Arctic seabed? New science says the real threat is much closer to home. Two new papers pinpoint the real culprit of growing methane, the oil and gas industry. This is very big news science. The bad news is methane from fossil fuels is warping world weather. The good news, it is us and not nature who causes and controls the worst emissions of this greenhouse gas. It all comes in two new papers based on projects measuring air from ice cores in Antarctica and Greenland. Our guest is Michael Dionysius, who led one paper and co-authored the other. Michael is a PhD candidate at the University of Rochester, a private research university in New York State. Michael Dionysius, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, this is going to be cool. Now, when was the most recent time that Earth was warmer than today?
It depends on the region, but I think one of the most recent time is the period we call the Holocene Climate Optimum. It occurred around 10,000 to 8,000 years ago. So this is when the Earth was coming out of the last glacial maximum. In the last glacial maximum, you know, we have like ice sheets covering essentially all of Canada, and then a large chunk of the United States. New York City was under a mile of ice sheets. And then the ice sheet kind of melts away naturally through changes in solar insulation. And then there's a little bit of an overshoot effect. That's the period that is the Holocene climate optimum around 10,000 to 8,000 years ago. In this period, overall, the planet is about 0.2 to 0.4 degrees warmer, but the Arctic specifically is about 1 to 2 degrees warmer than today. So this is kind of like what we're looking forward to in the next couple of decades, what would it look like.
So why did you go to Antarctica to check the atmosphere over 10,000 years ago?
The way ice cores work is that as snow accumulates on top of ice sheets, you know, snow is porous, so it traps air in the interstitial space between the snow grains. And then as the snow compacts further into ice, the air in between the grains are trapped forever as air bubbles. And so through ice cores, actually, we could measure what was in the atmosphere thousands of years ago. So this exact is literally the sample of a piece of atmospheric air back through time. So we went to Greenland and Antarctica just to get a sample of air from the past.
So when the planet was up to half a degree C warmer than it is today, what did your ice core samples tell you about methane emissions in that warmer time? Were they extreme? Were they really bad?
The methane is still lower than today, actually. It's about half than today. So human emissions have almost more than doubled the methane concentration from the pre-industrial period to what we call the modern period or today. So even during this period where everything was warmer, methane was actually lower than today.
But how do you know that methane from ice in Antarctica represents the general atmosphere of that time instead of just local conditions at the pole?
We know based on several things. So first of all, there is continuity. So we have methane measurements today dating back all the way from the 80s in South Pole. So it's measured in situ in South Pole from the NOAA monitoring network. And then beyond the South Pole, we have what we call fern air. So this is air that is in the interstitial space in the snow grains that we could pump out of the ice sheets that is slightly older than 1980s, and it matches right into what are the in-situ measurements in South Pole. The reason why we know it's representative of global methane concentration, or should we say almost global, because methane is slightly higher in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere. So Greenland and Antarctic ice cores actually measure methane with slight offsets between them. But we know they represent global methane, not local methane, because we know the atmospheric lifetime of methane. So methane is removed in the atmosphere from oxidation with what we call OH radical. And average lifetime of one molecule of methane is about 9 years, while the interhemispheric mixing between atmosphere is about 1 year. So methane is what we call globally well mixed, although obviously methane is higher in regions where it's emitted by a lot, but still it's globally well mixed and there is a global baseline of methane.
Now, we know large amounts of methane have been resting on the seafloor for a very long time, captured in ice structures that we call clathrates. And a few scientists, including the Russians Natalia Shakova and Igor Samilyatov, have warned those clathrates are starting to thaw under the shallow East Siberian seabed. And as you know, a whole culture of worry and, well, doom have grown up around that. Michael, what makes you think that concern has been misplaced?
I just want to talk a little bit about the tracer that we use both in mine and bend studies. So we use a tracer, what we call a radiocarbon of methane. So it's a C14 measurement in the methane phase. So C14 is produced in the atmosphere basically from cosmic rays bombardment and reacting with nitrogen in the atmosphere to produce C14. And then the C14 is integrated into the biosphere because, you know, plants take up CO2 and then use it to build carbon as part of their, like, body parts through photosynthesis. And then when this plant dies, they either rot in a wetland and then get re-emitted as methane back to the atmosphere, or if the plants got eaten by a cow and then the cow's stomach have bacteria that produce methane and get emitted through the cow burps. So that's what we call contemporaneous methane. And the methane in these contemporaneous sources like the wetlands or cows or plants, they have the C14 content that is similar to atmospheric CO2. However, there's also fossil methane, and this is methane that have been isolated from the atmosphere for a while. So the clathrate that our colleagues are measuring in the ocean floor, or the methane in permafrost, or the methane in natural gas, they don't have C14 in it. So what we did is we go back to our ice cores and we measure C14 of methane in periods where methane jumps naturally. So there were two big jumps of methane when the Earth was coming out of the last glacial maximum. Methane almost doubled in what we call the oldest, driest Bolling-Alerod transition. And then methane also doubles in what we call the younger, driest transition. And people have been debating, like, what was causing this methane concentration rise during these two abrupt transitions. This transition happened in less than 100 years. And during these transitions, Greenland actually warmed by like 5-6 degrees. So that is pretty extreme natural variability in Earth's climate. And when we measure the C14 of methane, we only see the contemporaneous C14 methane. So the C14 content of methane that we measure in our ice cores was similar to C14 of CO2. And we know the C14 of CO2 really well from tree rings. And they all just measure about the same after we do the age correction. And that suggests that all this methane during the doubling of methane, during the oldest, driest Bolling warming, and then during the younger, driest warming, is all from contemporaneous source. Because if there's any fossil source like the clathrate destabilizing and releasing methane to the atmosphere, then we would see a depletion in the C14 of methane from the ice cores.
So we could go, say, half a degree C warmer than we are right now and not expect to see a big burp of methane coming up from the clathrates or the permafrost according to what happened the last time. But we have to remember that some scientists are now warning that we could warm another 1.5 degrees C by the end of this century. So does that overcome the assurances that you made in your new research? I mean, you told one journalist that's one climate catastrophe we can check off.
Yes, our research specifically pertains to the old methane. And we identify several buffer mechanisms that prevent this methane from reaching the atmosphere. So methane hydrates and permafrost are two different things. So methane hydrates, or as we mentioned it before, clathrates, they're just synonym. These are C14 dead methane, so they don't have any C14 in it. They're about thousands or hundreds of thousands of years in the ocean floor. And they're always in the ocean floor because they're not stable if under low pressure. And there's modern experiment done by our friends at British Petroleum when they did the Deepwater Horizon spill. They drill into a clathrate deposit and it explodes and it releases tons of methane to the water column. But actually, we don't see any of those methane made it to the atmosphere. And scientists, including John Kessler, who also works in my department, and Carolyn Ruppel, who is the head of the United States Geological Survey Hydrate Program, measure that all of those methane released from the clathrate are actually oxidized by bacteria in the water column. With regards to clathrate catastrophe, I think the BP oil spill and also my research happened to suggest that the oxidative capacity of the water column is so strong that the methane released from clathrates would likely not made it to the atmosphere. With regards to permafrost, it's slightly different because permafrost doesn't only emit C14 dead methane. There could be something in between. So what we mean by C14 dead is that if it's more than 2 or 3 half-lives of C14, which is around 6,000 years, then all of the C14 are depleted. But permafrost are actually about, a lot of permafrost today are about 5,000 to 10,000 years, so they're not quite C14 free. And what we only measure is the C14 free component of the permafrost emissions. We say that the old organic soil in permafrost were not emitted to the atmosphere as methane, but as permafrost melt, it could also, like, if you have plants that grow like last year, and then the plants die, and the permafrost melt, it creates what we call a thermocrust lake, which is basically a permafrost melt lake, and then the plant rot on the bottom of the lake, and then it releases methane. The methane released from those plants would still have C14 in it, and that's not part of our study. So with permafrost, we have to be slightly more careful than with clathrate. With clathrate, I think we could safely say that it's checked off, that this oxidative capacity or the water column is so strong. But with permafrost, we only say that the old organic carbon in permafrost are not reactivated and joining the ocean atmosphere carbon cycle.
So we're talking about a paper titled Old Carbon Reservoirs Were Not Important in the Deglacial Methane Budget. Our guest, Michael Dionysius, is the lead author. It was published in the journal Science on February 21st, 2020.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. So let's move on to another issue here. In March 2019, Professor Ewan Nisbet from the Royal Holloway, University of London, told us about his tests of flasks of air gathered from all over the world. He concluded that recent increases in methane were principally coming from tropical bogs, especially in East Africa. But you and Benjamin Hamil and Vivi Petrenko just published a second paper, this time in the journal Nature, February 19th. And it sounds like this new research points at the oil and gas industry instead?
A couple of things to clarify. So first of all, with this study, we measure fern air and ice core from Greenland. So we're moving away from Antarctica. And the reason why we moved to Greenland is because the accumulation rate is higher in Greenland. So it's easier to access air that is about pre-industrial age. So pre-industrial is around 1800s before James Watt invented the steam engine and start burning coal and emitting a bunch of fossil fuel to the atmosphere. And so we also measure radiocarbon of methane in those fern air and ice cores from Greenland. And basically what we see is that before 1850, basically there is no fossil methane in the atmosphere. And then the fossil methane starts to ramp up around 1850, coincidental with the pre-industrial period. And then, unfortunately, there's a gap because the bomb spike happened. So this is in the 1950s. There's a lot of nuclear testing, a lot of nuclear bomb being detonated, and it spiked the atmospheric C14. So you remember our discussion with the tracers of how C14 of methane work. Now the contemporaneous source like wetlands and biomass burning, plants, cows, they all emit enriched C14 methane. So that the proxies sadly doesn't work these days or today or beyond 1950, but it works in the past. So as I mentioned, another source of methane that people think is real is what we call natural geologic emissions. So it's basically seeps of natural gas that happens naturally. So through like a fault in a rock formation or through mud volcanoes or just seepage like that. And actually, when we go back to the pre-industrial, we see that there is almost no fossil methane. So that means that the seepage that we think was natural was actually just fossil fuel emissions. So that's why we say that anthropogenic fossil fuel emission was underestimated today. But we actually did not directly address the present methane rise from 2008 to today. What we mean by present in the paper was actually the methane stabilization period. So we're not saying that fossil fuel was responsible for the methane rise that we're currently seeing. What we're saying is that fossil fuel has been higher all along under our nose.
You know, one thing I love about both these studies is they're based on ice core records. They're real solid measurements in the real world. They're not models. They're not projections. So it's kind of hard to argue with your work, but some scientists have attempted to argue with your work, and there's been some pushback to your conclusions. What have you heard?
Some of the pushbacks are not related to the measurements, because I think we spend like 90% of the time making sure the measurement is good. So with regards to the one pushback with regards to Ben's studies from Daniel Jacob at Harvard is that he's saying that, all right, we clearly show that natural geologic emission was small, but it doesn't mean that anthropogenic fossil fuel has to be higher. It could also mean that we just overestimate natural geologic emission. And in that way, if fossil fuel stays where it is and natural geologic emission was small, then he could balance the methane budget. So we have a problem these days with the methane budget, between the discrepancy between what we call top-down inversions and bottom-up measurements. In top-down measurements, we have monitoring stations across the world. Some stations are slightly better than others, but the point is that we could figure out how much methane in total is coming up just from these measurements, from atmospheric measurement. The bottom-up measurement is that you go to a lake or you go to a permafrost and you have a bucket atmosphere. And unfortunately, scientists are attracted to big hotspots, or like just we want to measure where methane, there's a lot of methane or there's a lot of interesting things. So the bottom-up studies actually overestimate the amount of methane compared to what the top-down inversion shows. So there's this basically gap in the budget that have to be reconciled. So one argument from Daniel Jacob is that, all right, so if we say that fossil natural geologic emission is low, then you just close the gap and we solve the problem. You don't have to increase the fossil fuel component. An argument against that is that in the paper we do box model of stable isotopes of methane. This time we're talking about C13 to C12 ratio of methane rather than the radiocarbon that we've been talking previously. And when we do the stabilized isotopes box model, it seems like the fossil fuel component still needs to be higher. So that's kind of like our answer to the argument that you should just have the natural geologic emissions lower and don't increase the fossil fuel component.
Well, everything you're saying matches up with what we've heard here on this show. I mean, I interviewed in January 2020 the energy reporter Nick Cunningham, and he told us about companies fracking for oil in West Texas, legally venting tons of natural gas into the air. They just blow it up there. And we've seen air samples showing fracking is emitting significant amounts of methane, and natural gas pipelines from Russia to America are pretty leaky. So are the distribution systems in the city. So it just makes common sense. We had that 2018 study by Ramon Alvarez that found methane coming from the oil and gas supply chain much higher than what the government said. So it all seems to back up the conclusion that you come through. Now, is the increase in methane large enough to derail this goal of keeping global warming well below 2 degrees as set in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So Ewan Nisbet actually wrote a paper about that we're way off target from Paris Agreement just because of the methane emissions that has been unexpectedly increasing, because methane was stabilizing around 2000 to 2009, and then it just keeps ramping up. And the rate of methane increase today is about as high or higher than what we've ever seen in all ice core history. And so, yeah, we're way off target for Paris for the methane rise. But we're still not sure whether it's 100% fossil fuel or it could be other thing, because obviously, so with regards to the stabilized dose methane, there are three main hypotheses. The first one is the one that Ewan Nisbet proposed. That is the most straightforward hypothesis. What happened currently is that atmospheric methane concentration is rising, and the atmospheric methane stable isotope is becoming depleted, so it becomes way lighter. So Ewan Nisbet proposed that it's actually the wetlands, the bogs in the tropics that are driving this isotopic depletion and methane increase. That's because the wetlands are emitting very negative, very light methane. So that is the most straightforward hypothesis. The second hypothesis is that you could also increase fossil fuel, but you need to make room in the budget for also a decrease in biomass burning. If you don't decrease the biomass burning, then the isotope budget doesn't quite work out with increase in fossil fuel, because fossil fuel have slightly higher stable isotopes than microbial emission from wetlands. And argument about reduction in biomass burning, obviously we know the terrible fires in Australia and Amazon last year. Just from that perspective, it's fairly strenuous, but there's also massive reduction in or fire suppression happening in the Northern Hemisphere, because when there's fire now, people have concerted effort to put it down. So that could be also correct. And the third hypothesis is that there's actually just simply, so the sinks of methane, what removes methane from the atmosphere is reaction with OH radical. And the OH radical only exists in atmosphere for about 1 second, so it's a very reactive molecule, and we cannot actually measure them, because if you trap them in a flask and you bring them to the lab, they're gone. And they're constantly produced by sunlight, so they're constantly appearing and disappearing, and it's very hard to measure it. So we have to rely on models. Some models suggest that the OH radical have been decreasing, so basically means that we're just removing less methane from atmosphere. So those are the three hypotheses. And at the moment, unfortunately, we don't have enough measurements or constraints to figure out which one, or these three could also be correct, because we're dealing with a multivariate problem. It could be a combination of all three in some percentage more than others.
But we do know the fossil fuel industry is dumping more methane into the atmosphere than ever happened before the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's definitely true. But it's still hard to reconcile the isotope budget with fossil fuel alone, I think.
So when we take these new papers into consideration, you find there's some good news hidden in the way strong warming methane is increasing. What's the good news part of this?
Well, so first of all, the first paper about clathrates and old carbon in permafrost are straight up good news. We say that clathrate, even if they destabilize, they're unlikely to significantly affect atmospheric methane. And the old carbon in permafrost also are unlikely to be emitted to the atmosphere as methane. With regards to the findings that fossil fuel emission has been higher all along under our nose, the kind of good news is that that means that we have more control over what we emit. So any regulation that reduce leaks from pipelines or like prevent like flaring or regulate abandoned drill rigs to make sure that oil companies, after they finish with their site, they clean it up and they make sure that everything is capped off and not leaking, they have significantly more leverage against the current methane rise than we thought. So they give you more bang for your buck of regulation costs. And another good news is that basically the methane in the atmosphere is in our hand, and if you flunk it, then it's your fault. Like you don't have anyone else to blame but human emissions. You can't blame the permafrost, you can't blame the cloud rates.
After publishing two papers in major journals and following two pretty big expeditions to Greenland and Antarctica, what is next for you, Michael?
I'm still doing methane stuff. I just submitted my PhD dissertation last week, and I'm going to take up a postdoc in University of Copenhagen, which is one of the pioneering place where they start drilling ice cores. So yeah, I'm excited to go there in the next couple of months.
Well, you can find links to these two papers in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Follow up and make your own judgment. From the University of Rochester, Michael Dionysius, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
As I tried to make clear in this interview, I would not say the science on what will happen with Arctic methane is totally settled. The actual numbers about methane in past warmer climates is not in dispute, but some other scientists still question whether this applies to the present. Personally, I agree that the real threat is our unregulated emissions from the natural gas industry and the oil industry that vents gas as a byproduct. And we can do a lot to stop it from our own industry. Next week, I will be planting a lot more seeds in my geothermal greenhouse. Find my new course on how to build one at my website, ecoshock.org. I will also start putting a lot of nutritious soups into canning bottles to ride out any shortages after the inevitable food panic at the supermarkets. That's right. This year, there is a spring canning season due to the emergency. Capture what you can and store it without needing electricity. Next week on Radio EcoShock, who knows, maybe we will all be caught up in the coronavirus panic. No doubt so-called natural disasters, which are anything but natural, will continue to strike even as humans hunker down. Deep Greens are hoping this killer system will topple over to give us something better. I'm hoping it doesn't give us something worse. And most people are hoping the banks do not collapse, and maybe we will still have jobs by the time summer comes. How's that for dark optimism? I'm Alex Smith. See you next week on Radio EcoShock.